Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. With me now, Tara Wall, Senior Advisor to the Romney campaign. Ms. Wall, thank you very much for doing this. Hello.
Thanks for having me. Absolutely.
Let me ask you first to clarify something we've talked about on our air. Governor Romney on CBS Monday night said he was for an abortion ban except for rape, incest, and the life or health of the mother. Did you then pull back, including the health of the mother, as an allowable exception?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, the governor has made clear what his position is. He's made the exception for those three items, and that's what we've said. That's what he has said, and that's what he supports a pro-life platform. We support a pro-life platform, and with those three exceptions.
So health of the mother, because many conservatives who are for the exemption for life of the mother say health is such a loophole, such an elastic clause, that a doctor could write that in just to enable a woman to get an abortion. And so many conservatives oppose that health of the mother exemption. But that's not the governor's position, you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay. Also in that answer on CBS, Governor Romney seemed to accept Roe versus Wade as settled law. And let me play you just 10 seconds of that answer.
But recognize, this is the decision that will be made by the Supreme Court. The Democrats try and make this a political issue every 4 years, but this is a matter in the courts. It's been settled for some time in the courts.
Does Romney accept, Governor Romney, accept Roe versus Wade as settled law? He just said it's been settled for some time in the courts.
No, I think he has said that that's what the decision is now. He does not happen to be in agreement with that decision and would support efforts, if that decision were to be overturned.
So when he says it's not a political issue, and the Democrats shouldn't try to make it one, isn't it a political issue, at least as far as what kind of justices he would be likely to appoint to the Supreme Court versus President Obama?
Well, as you know, justices don't make decisions based on political reasons. It's based on law. I think at the end of the day, relative to politics in general, folks want to make a lot of issues political issues. I think to the degree that it's a political issue is what are people's personal beliefs and what gets them to the polls. I personally, support Governor Romney because I happen to be pro-life, and there are people who support candidates because of their personal beliefs, whether it's pro-life or pro-choice. And to that end, that's where politics weigh in. Will this be an overriding, pervasive political issue that determines the election? I don't know that to be the case.
But if you support Governor Romney largely because you're pro-life, wouldn't it be important to you that he appoint justices likely to view Roe as judicial activism?
Well, my personal views are that I would like to see conservative justices. That's who I am, and I support candidates who uphold and support conservative justices. At the end of the day, obviously there are going to be disagreements among Republicans, conservatives, moderates within the party relative to this very issue. I don't think that it should be a wedge issue, though.
Let me raise another aspect of women's health and this campaign. I want to play for you a clip of Governor Romney on Fox News Sunday this week and ask you something about it. The setup here is that Chris Wallace asked him about his problem with women voters, according to the polls, and here was his response.
Well, first of all, with regards to women's health care, look, I'm the guy that was able to get health care for all of the women and men in my state. They're just talking about it at the federal level. We actually did something, and we did it without cutting Medicare and without raising taxes, number one. Number two.
So you're saying look at Romneycare?
Well, absolutely. I'm very proud of what we did and the fact that we helped women and men and children in our state. Number two, and we did it without cutting Medicare, which obviously affects a lot of women. The way the president cut Medicare, $716 billion for current retirees, that's a real problem.
So that was a rare embrace of the Romneycare / Obamacare style of health reform. Does he now say it was a good thing for the people of Massachusetts?
Well, I think he's always made the distinction of the states having the flexibility and the ability to decide what works. He never supported a federal mandate and still does not support a federal mandate. At the end of the day, there are some of these programs, number one, that we look at it as needing cuts that need reform, Medicaid, Medicare among them. But at the same time, you still have to deal with me. I believe personally some of the least among us, and that is the elderly, the disabled, folks who are in disadvantaged socioeconomic situations. And so to that end, I believe that's what the governor is speaking to. And that is what the Constitution allows for, frankly. There is a certain level of expectation that the government identifies as ensuring that the least among us, I like to say, as a believer, the least among us is that that there should be ways that we make sure that they have access as well. And that's what our Constitution allows for. And I believe what the governor has supported is relative to how we allow states to have that flexibility, as opposed to the federal government making it a mandate. And I think that's what most Americans are opposed to, is, this government overreach relative to mandating health care, mandating raising taxes on Americans who don't happen to choose to delve into government-controlled health care. So we need to keep those options open for Americans, while at the same time ensuring that we are making those targeted cuts in areas that need to be cut.
I guess President Obama's position would be that for the least among us, something like the expansion of Medicaid under the Obama health law is very much in their interest, rather than making people rely on charity care at hospitals, and that doing it through the federal government is because the history of civil rights suggests that there are some states in the union that are not going to be very concerned with the least among us. And it's the federal government's role, it's been so historically, to protect them in a sense from the states.
Well, the government sets a tone, certainly. But I think that, at the end of the day, we have to some of these programs that the president has targeted, are unsustainable. When you're talking about Medicare, for example, and the $700 billion that was taken out of that to help pay for Obamacare, I think that people have to understand these programs, when they were designed, some of them, like Medicare, are not sustainable. They're going bankrupt at current rates, and I think that has a lot to do with livelihood, people living longer and stronger and healthier lives. And you have to revisit programs like that and reevaluate what makes sense. And to continue to expand for the sake of expansion, I think is setting bad precedent. And we have to look at other options. I worked in the Bush administration, and government cannot discount private organizations, faith, nonprofits, charities that really do a better job, in many cases, than the government at addressing the needs of those in these communities that are being impacted disproportionately. And I think it is incumbent upon government to partner with these agencies as a way to help alleviate the costs that are really overburdening many of our states now with these federal programs. So there is a balance there, and I think the balance, again, is what is it? How is it serving the person? How is it serving the taxpayer? And ensuring that our tax dollars are being used wisely as it relates to these programs.
My guest is Tara Wall, senior advisor to the Romney campaign. You referred to $700 billion being taken out of Medicare. The governor referred to it in his answer in the Fox News Sunday clip that we played. Democrats will argue that that's a distortion, and we'll deal with that in another segment with a different guest. But most of what they're cutting is the subsidies to insurance companies failing to make a profit in the marketplace under the Medicare Advantage plan, just what the Romney-Ryan plan hopes to see more of: private insurance companies trying to make a profit on senior citizens' health insurance with subsidies from the government. Doesn't Medicare Advantage prove that that model has already failed?
Well, I would say that, the governor does want to restore that funding to ensure that the 55 and older folks that have invested in this, have a stake, been promised this safety net when they retire, will be there, and it should be there. But I think that we have to go back and address again the folks of my generation for whom this will not be there. How do you deal with that? We have to begin to look at those options. And I think Romney and Ryan have a have great ideas on how to begin to address this in a sensible way, put some other options on the table that can include optional vouchers for seniors and other measures, again, that speak to, look at the health and viability, again, of our seniors nowadays and whether there are some concessions there. I think that overall, at the end of the day, we have to make sure that those programs that are already in place that don't pull the rug, so to speak, from out from under our 55 and older community right now are still preserved.
I want to ask you about one other thing. The birther joke that Governor Romney made before the convention drew such a dramatic response on television, maybe the most dramatic convention media moment so far, from Chris Matthews insisting to RNC Chairman Reince Priebus that this is racial code. Also, the official theme of the whole night that Governor Romney speaks Thursday night is "We believe in America," which might seem to imply that President Obama doesn't believe in America. Otherness of President Obama. Talk about that.
You know, I think the Democrats are just, you know, they're reading way too much into this. There are many people who could say that they are, you know, appalled at some of the comments that Biden has made relative to race. There is no way and no how that you can tie what was a joke about being at home and being nostalgic in his hometown, that you can tie that into some type of racial connotation or undertone. I think it's absurd. I think it's another play by liberals and Democrats, as they always do every election, to try to trump up false race charges on the other side. It's ridiculous. I reject it. And Republicans reject it, and the campaign rejects it. It's absolutely absurd. There are many black Americans like myself, Hispanics, others, who this is all of our country. We are proud of our country. We, as small business owners like myself, did build it, and we shouldn't be ashamed to say that.
What does "We Believe in America" mean as a convention night theme, if not to imply that President Obama somehow doesn't believe in America?
Well, I don't know that that does convey that President Obama doesn't believe in America. No one has said that.
Say anything you want to all those swing voters out there. 60 seconds of open mic.
Well, we're excited about the enthusiasm actually going into this campaign and going into this convention, I should say, because we've seen the numbers come together quite well with our swing voters. We're looking nationally at the polls that are starting to balance out almost even, if not having Governor Romney slightly ahead in some of those pivotal states like the Florida and Virginia and Michigan. So we're excited about the momentum, and we're excited about the message that this campaign brings for a We Can Do Better America. There were problems, there were promises made and not kept with this administration. I think a Romney-Ryan ticket is going to convey the difference between a pro-growth agenda and a big government agenda.
Tara Wall, senior advisor to the Romney campaign, thank you so much for taking some time on Radio Row.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next from the Republican convention, former mayor Rudy Giuliani. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now from the Republican convention, former Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Mr. Mayor, so nice of you to take some convention time for us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
What did you think of the speeches last night?
Well, I was there for Ann Romney's speech, and I was there for Chris Christie's speech. I thought both of them accomplished what they were supposed to accomplish. I was particularly impressed with Mrs. Romney's speech, only because she's not really a professional at doing that, and I know from having given a lot of speeches, it's really difficult at first. And I thought she was enormously relaxed, and I thought she delivered a very nice picture of her husband, what he's like, why she cares about him so much, and how hard he'll work for the country. And I thought she took on something he's been uncomfortable taking on, which is all these attacks on his success. I've kept thinking, my goodness, that's the reason I'd like him to be president, because he's been so successful in private life. I'd like him to have that same kind of success as president that he had for Bain Capital. And I thought she got that message across, that isn't a negative, it's a positive.
How would you compare what Governor Christie was trying to do for Mitt Romney in his keynote speech and what you were trying to do in yours for John McCain 4 years ago?
Well, I think we had different objectives from the convention. I mean, I think like me, he had to give the speech the convention wanted him to give, pretty much, which was a philosophical one, one in which he was contrasting a failed presidency with a group of failed ideas, a lack of leadership, an unwillingness to take on difficult things like Medicare, his president's inability to get a budget passed, even with a Democratic Congress. He had to contrast that with a different vision of America, which is a more entrepreneurial one, one in which we'll take on some of these issues that Democrats have been unwilling to take on, the way like he has done, and like the governors in four or five other states have done. So I think that was his mission. I think he accomplished it really well. In my case, my mission was to focus on President Obama's lack of experience to be president of the United States, which I'm very proud I did because I think I turned out to be a prophet. The president has had a real failed presidency for 4 years, particularly in the area of leadership.
And the Democrats would have something else to say about that, but we'll leave that conversation for another day.
Of course they would, but I think if you look at the unemployment rate, highest it's been since the Depression, the number of people that are permanently unemployed, the highest it's been since the Depression, his failure to pass a budget even with a Democratic Congress, my goodness, I mean, this president, even his followers say he leads by following, which is an oxymoron.
Do you see some of yourself in Chris Christie as a tough-talking prosecutor turned executive?
I do. Even more than you would think. Like that expression he used last night that his mother said, it's better to be respected than loved.
Yeah.
My father used to tell me that. My father told me it's more important that you respect me than love me. And if you respect me, you'll eventually love me the right way.
I'm curious if you think that from either side of the aisle, there are pluses and minuses to this style. Eliot Spitzer is a Democratic example. You're all seen as take no prisoners guys, and you make a lot of enemies as well as a lot of friends along the way.
Well, I think what we're really good for is when you really have to change things. You know, I think Chris was the perfect choice as a governor of a state that was in a disaster in terms of its budget and economy and needed somebody who's willing to take on things that other people aren't willing to take on. Somebody that's been in politics all their life, they've sort of, you know, go along to get along and get along to go along, and they're not willing to take on the kinds of changes that have to be made when you have to change a city, a state, or a country. So there are times in which we're effective and probably times in which we're probably not the right choice.
Does Christie's plain-spokenness and clarity of values rub off on Mitt Romney enough? Romney has been much more of a chameleon as a politician in ways that Christie hasn't.
Well, look, they're both different. I mean, Governor Romney's background has been enormously successful in business, enormously successful running the Olympics, successful as a governor. He's been more in the world of making very, very practical decisions, not in the world of ideology, which is why I think sometimes people wonder, well, he's had several different positions on things. He hasn't come at politics from the point of view of ideology. He's come at politics from the point of view of how do you get things done? How do you run Massachusetts as a business? And I think that'll be really good for us. I think he's going to be a very practical president, and I think we can use that. I think anyone worried about his excessive ideology just has to look at his past to understand that this man is essentially a pragmatist. He's a conservative leanings. He'll go in that direction most of the time, but I think by and large he's a pragmatist.
Do you see a parallel in that respect between Romney's starting point and yours and your presidential campaign? You both had to govern as Republicans in Democratic Northeastern jurisdictions, then turn around and run a Republican primary campaign with that very conservative base. Do you relate to that?
Oh, sure I do. I mean, There are a lot of similarities between Governor Romney being elected in Massachusetts and my being elected in New York in a Democratic stronghold, or even Chris Christie being elected in New Jersey. I think when you get elected and you have to govern like that, no matter what goes on in a campaign and you say in a campaign, you learn the skills of being a practical leader. You know, somebody, I couldn't have everything I wanted. If I tried to get everything I wanted, I would have gotten nothing from a Democratic city council. I had to be willing to concede. I had to agree to programs I didn't agree with in order to get tax reductions that I wanted. So you learn how to do that. And I think that's something that was not, frankly, in President Obama's background. He has always he never was an executive before, and he talked a very good game about being bipartisan, but he wasn't. He was the most extreme partisan in the Senate as a Democrat, and he's pretty much completely cut Republicans out, even when he had a Democratic Congress. He figured he could just ignore them. So I think it would be good for this country if we have a president, no matter what they say during an election, who's willing to sit down with the Democrats and work things out, maybe a fresh start. And I think Governor Romney's capable of that.
But how do we know which Mitt Romney would be president? The pragmatic Romney Care governor of Massachusetts you were just describing, or the more right-wing political persona he has adopted since?
I think what you're going to get is a pragmatist. I mean, you're going to get a man who wants to accomplish things, wants to get things done. I think ideology will guide some of that, but it won't have him in a straitjacket the way it might with someone who's been in politics all his life and is absolutely convinced that he's absolutely right about everything and can never change his mind.
Former Mayor Rudy Giuliani, my guest from the Republican convention. By the way, as we've been doing with a lot of our guests on Radio Row, we just tweeted a photograph of him in a lovely yellow polka dot tie, I might say. So check it out. Follow me at Brian Lehrer. About New York City, it's hard to believe it's been 10 years since you left office. How do you think Mayor
Sometimes it's hard for me to believe it, too.
How do you think Mayor Bloomberg has done?
Oh, I think Mike has done a great job. I look at the big picture, not the small little things that people might disagree about. He's been terrific for the economy of New York. He's kept New York safe. He's kept New York safe even against the extra pressures that he had that I didn't have about terrorism that had become a much bigger and greater concern after the attacks of September 11. He's treated New York City as a business. He's run it like very much what I'm saying about Governor Romney in a very, very practical way. And then I was really worried when I was leaving office before September 11 happened that a lot of the things that I started, a lot of the things that I changed would be all changed back. And instead, he's preserved them and he's made them better. The way he's used statistics and metrics to grade the government agencies and trying to get it away from just pure politics, I think, has been absolutely terrific. And whoever succeeds him, I think it's really going to be hard to take the city back to pre-1994 after so many years of being governed in a more business-like way.
And, of course, the city hasn't had a Democratic Party mayor since you took office in 94, but I'm not sure there is a Republican or independent out there this time to challenge whoever the Democratic nominee is. Do you see anyone on the horizon?
So far, no one has come along. But, you know, when I first started in 89, I didn't really get started until February of the election year. Now, that probably was a mistake. But some of these challenges don't come along until the very beginning of the election year. So we're going to have to wait and see. There is a certain feeling that there could be room for a sort of independent candidate, but I don't know who that person would be right now.
You have anyone you would want to promote?
Oh, there probably are a couple, but I probably have to ask their permission before I promoted them. That's the way it happened to me. Guy Molinari did it to me. I really wasn't thinking all that much about running for mayor, and it was right after the 1988 election. Guy Molinari was on. He was on one of the talk shows, and he said, and he was asked that question you just asked, and he said, "Well, this prosecutor Rudy Giuliani could run. He'd be good. There's a lot of crime, and he'd be able to solve it. And he's a tough guy, and all this other stuff." And within a day, I got all these calls at my office, and that's how it really started.
Interesting history for those who hadn't heard it. Could you support any of the Democratic hopefuls, potentially? Christine Quinn, I'm thinking of especially, seems to be working hard to be broadly acceptable.
Well, I don't know if I could. I mean, I've supported Democrats before. Mario Cuomo was the most famous one that I did, but also I've supported some for city council and state assembly. I don't know if I ever supported anyone for Congress. I might have. Sure. I mean, see, I think about city politics, that you should get Democrat, Republican, all that stuff out of it. I would have like to see nonpartisan elections.
That's Mayor Bloomberg's position, too.
Yeah, for the city, because believe me, Mayor LaGuardia, who is who is the predecessor that we probably all admire the most, used to say there's no Democratic or Republican way to pick up the garbage. You know, mayors have to make enormously practical decisions about what's best for their city. And the political parties don't spend their ideology doesn't really spend an awful lot of time thinking about how cities should be governed. Most of the ideology is about how states and the national government should be governed. So you look at somebody like Rahm Emanuel, who's taking on the unions in Chicago.
Who'd have
thunk it? My goodness, right? Or Ed Rendell was my contemporary when I was mayor, and he's still a very good friend. And I don't think on issues involving the city, Ed Rendell and I probably agreed on 90% of the issues, even though he was a Democrat and I was a Republican.
I remember you coming into office saying Ed Rendell, who was then mayor of Philadelphia, was one of your role models.
Right. I invited him to Gracie Mansion about a month after I was elected to talk to my commissioners and give them sort of a briefing on how to conduct themselves and what to be expected of them. I had a couple of Republican and a couple of Democratic mayors come in. We had like a little private conference so that we could sort of get some advantage of their experience. And it's really true. I mean, mayors pretty much face the same issues, and about 90% of the time they come to the same answers,
as
whether they're Democrats or Republicans.
As a New York Republican at these conventions, do you ever feel alienated from some of the more socially conservative base of the party? Mm-hmm. Even Paul Ryan, for example, saying no exception to abortion bans for rape and things like that?
No, because the reality is I agree on so many other things. And in New York, sometimes I feel more comfortable when I'm speaking outside New York, because then when I talk about my economic philosophy and foreign policy thinking, it's much more familiar and much more comfortable. I used to say about New York that people in New York agreed with the results, but not with the philosophy that got to those results. And so there's I'm not at home either place completely. And I'm not foreign in either place completely. Yeah. I mean, I'm a foreign policy conservative, an economic conservative, and a social moderate. And there'd be people at this convention who probably think I'm a social liberal, right?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about
that. That's the way I am, and I'm happy with it. And they accept me here, and they accept me in New York, but they'd all like me to be 100% the way they are, and I'm not.
One more of those issues, if I might. The party platform section on guns jumped out at me because it seemed to be written specifically in response to the movie theater massacre, digging in on no limits to the capacity of clips in magazines. We know Mayor Bloomberg thinks that's pretty awful. How about you?
Well, I haven't seen that part of the platform. Frankly, to be honest with you, Brian, I never read the platform. Never read a platform. Don't think they really mean very much. I think that the Second Amendment gives people the right to bear arms. Whether you like it or not, that's a constitutional right as important in the Constitution as others. That doesn't mean there can't be reasonable restrictions on the right to bear arms, where we can make sure that somebody is a responsible person, is of the right age. I kind of think of it like driving, right? We have a right to drive, but we don't have an unlimited right to drive. We have to be at a certain age. We have to be able to physically function. We need to know the rules of the road, and if we abuse it, they can take away that right. And I think that's the framework in which I look at gun rights. The rights exist, but there can be reasonable regulation of those rights. And I'd have to look at the platform to see if it goes too far. I mean, I think Democrats go too far in trying to blame all crimes on guns, and Republicans go too far on resisting any form of reasonable regulation of the right to bear arms, which is an important one, but still one that can be regulated.
We have about 3 minutes left with former Mayor Rudy Giuliani joining us at the Republican convention. One other city issue, your legacy, along with responding to 9/11, is strongest on fighting crime. And these days, the city is debating stop and frisk, as you know, which Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Kelly are doing way more than I think was done under you. Maybe you counted differently, but 700,000 in a year, which result in only a 10% arrest or violation rate. And you've seen all the backlash to that. Does it give you pause at all that the police stop so many innocent people?
Well, you know, I don't know what the conditions are today, so I can only tell you what it was like when I was mayor. I was attacked for stop and frisk. In fact, Elliot Spitzer, as attorney general, was investigated us. The Janet Reno Justice Department investigated us. They finally dropped the investigation for racial profiling because it turned out that like 7 out of 10 people that were stopped and frisked were African-American. And the theory was, well, they're only 25% of the population. But the reality was that if you looked at the number of crimes, you looked at the crime complaints, our police were being directed to stop and frisk African-Americans because other African-Americans were reporting that the crimes that committed against them were committed by African-Americans. So, you know, 7 out of 10 of the crime complaints, which generated from African-Americans, so they weren't racist in nature, came from African-Americans.
But the sheer volume of them, maybe the bar is too low. Some would say the bar is too low for what warrants a stop.
I don't know. I can't answer. I have tremendous confidence in Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Kelly. I think Commissioner Kelly has been a terrific police commissioner. He's had to deal with something that is much more difficult than you realize. You know, when I took over, crimes were through the roof. We had just been averaging 2,000 murders a year, 12,000 felonies a week. It was ridiculous. We were the crime capital of America. We were on the cover of Time magazine as the rotting of the Big Apple. In some ways, it was really hard to reduce crime and change the mentality. But in many ways, it's really harder to continue to reduce crime after you've reduced it so much. So Commissioner Kelly's done a great job. And I have to tell you, Brian, I suspect, and this could be my New York cynicism, that some of this stop and frisk thing is being done because they don't want Ray Kelly to run in the Democratic primary for mayor. I think some of this has been directed to stop Ray Kelly from running for office because he looked like a pretty powerful candidate and he kind of fit the profile of what you were asking me about before. And in Ray's case, he's a Democrat, but somebody who is sort of independent outside of the political process. So I wonder if there isn't some political motivation to this also.
Before you go, are you done with the public sector for yourself?
Oh, I never say that. You never know in life what gets presented to you, what opportunities there are. I'm very happy. I'm not looking for anything else. I run a security business, a wonderful law firm, Bracewell Giuliani. I have plenty of time to get involved in politics, sort of with a lot of freedom now, and I give speeches all over the world. So I'm not unhappy in my life. I'm very happy, but I love public service, and if some opportunity came along that I can't conceive of right now, I probably would take it.
Governor Christie said he doesn't want to be Romney's attorney general. Would you consider that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. I'd have to first he'd have to get elected, and then he'd have to consider me, and we'd have to talk about it. And there are a lot of other people as well, so we'd have to see.
Former Mayor Rudy Giuliani, thank you so much for giving us this time.
Thank
you,
Brian. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a satirist's eye view of the Republican convention. It's Baratunde Thurston. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the station has reporters, producers, editors, and engineers at the Republican convention. We also have comedian Baratunde Thurston poking around for us. He's a former politics editor at The Onion, as many of you know, the founder of the website Jack and Jill Politics, and the author of the book How to Be Black. He also did stand-up with Grover Norquist last night, I'm told. Baratunde, hi from New York.
Hello from Tampa. How you doing, Brian?
I'm doing all right. So tell us what you've been up to. What hat do you have on at the RNC? Is it your comedy hat, your black politics hat, or your tri-corner RNC commemorative flag hat?
I probably have on my I didn't hear what Rudy Giuliani said, but likely disagree with everything he said hat. So it's good to be here. I always have my Baratunde hat on. Lots of jobs going on, trying to stay afloat in the economy, keep myself busy. And it's been a fun and sweaty time down here.
One thing you've been getting a pretty big reaction to is a hashtag you started on Twitter, quote, Negro spotting. And you're literally counting black people at the convention?
Yes, I am. In fact, we just got to 121 as I'm sitting here in the WNYC booth on Radio Row at the Tampa Convention Center. As you've heard, most likely Mitt Romney's support among black people is at an effective 0%. Even before that came out, I was just sort of curious, coming down to my first ever RNC, how many black people I would see. And I've gone very inclusive with my count because it's hard to tell who's media, who's a delegate. And so if you're within the convention operations, you count. So I've come across security guards and vendors, as well as actual GOP members.
And do you just count, or do you engage them in conversation about the fact that you're counting?
Occasionally both. So when I reached 99 yesterday, that was actually CNN's Joe Johns. That was pretty cool. He was very excited to be featured on the list. Amongst my earliest list, I'm staying out in Clearwater, Florida, at the hotel where the New York State GOP delegation is. And I saw these two dudes, they're wearing suits. I'm like, that's leaning a Republican in this heat. You're probably a GOP member if you're wearing a suit in 88-degree heavy humidity. And they actually were state law enforcement. But they had been mistaken repeatedly for bellhops at the hotel by delegates showing up and sort of assuming that they would take their bags. So their lesson to me was, don't stand too near the hotel entrance. And they had to avoid some awkward situations by doing that. I also met a woman from Crown Heights, Brooklyn, Marilyn Miller, and she is an actual New York delegate and member. And she was gracious enough to invite me to breakfast. And I saw former Senator Al D'Amato speak. So there are many flavors of black here, just a very small amount.
Let's talk about some of the speeches last night. You flagged the two takes on love back-to-back from the Ann Romney and Chris Christie speeches. We'll remind our listeners of those.
I want to talk to you from my heart about our hearts tonight. I want to talk to you about love.
See, I believe we have become paralyzed by our desire to be loved.
So the GOP is confused about their stance on love?
I mean, the GOP is confused about its stance on a lot of issues. I was actually on the floor during Ann Romney's talk, and I was on the floor during Michelle Obama's talk 4 years ago. This is my one pure parallel experience. And she had that crowd, and people were enraptured, and they were listening. The level of raw enthusiasm, I would say, wasn't as high as the Democrats had for now First Lady Obama, but it was way up there. And when she hit that line about love, there was this palpable, like, oh, yeah, love. And then Chris Christie comes, I was like, hey, I love, who needs it? So there was a kind of a gut punch from the fittingly New Jersey governor, but it represented a bit of a split face, not too deep, but a fun rhetorical observation nonetheless.
It's a love-hate relationship with love. You told us that Rick Santorum caught your ear when he talked about government help, and here's that clip.
My grandfather, like millions of other immigrants, didn't come here for some government guarantee of income equality or government benefits to take care of his family. In 1923, there were no government benefits for immigrants except one, freedom.
Baratunde, did you get your freedom check in the mail this month?
I've been waiting for it, just the handout from the government, my freedom handout, and it's not coming. And I was just so surprised to hear Rick Santorum use the language of government handout with respect to anything, even though I know he was trying to make this point about freedom is the only thing you can get, but even that doesn't come from the government, according to his own argument. So I didn't think he really thought through the words he said. Also, the mood in the room for him, it wasn't hot. You know, people weren't super enthusiastic, super engaged, and that's the benefit of being actually in the room and not remotely hearing applause through the mic. Was very muted for Santorum, and I was a little surprised by that.
I watched that on television. I thought he was giving his acceptance speech. And at the end,
he presents like a winner. He definitely does.
It was almost like, okay, yeah, now you're going to give me the crown, right? Where is everybody? All right,
everybody just wants to be liked.
Here, but not loved. Here's another moment from Ted Cruz, Republican Senate candidate from Texas.
Can we restore the Constitution? Yes, we can. Can we retake the Senate? Can we repeal Obamacare? And can we defeat President Barack Obama?
I've heard that line somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere deep in our history, the Yes We Can chant has been used in U.S. politics. It was just annoying and weird to have this Tea Party Senate candidate, of all people, wasn't a mainstream Republican, wasn't an establishment guy. This is like the heart of the opposition to Obamacare and the Obama Nation. To channel that chant was, you know, the height of a little bit of hypocrisy and a lot of awkwardness.
Of course, that's the point, isn't it? Because they're trying to point out that, in their view, Obama has been a failure, and no, he can't.
Yeah, but they couldn't really get the chant together either. So it was there, but it wasn't there. It was there are other ways to do it. There were some awkward, forced moments of crowd engagement last night. A woman asked for Colorado to give her a shout-out, and they just didn't. Colorado was just like, nope, we aren't excited about being Colorado at this very moment. So there was this blank moment in her talk. She's like, really, Colorado? And they're like, nope, really, we're not into this. Next speaker.
They're very mellow out there compared to New Yorkers. Baratunde Thurston casting his comedian and satirist's eye on the Republican convention. Brian Lehrer with him on WNYC. By the way, I saw that, what I thought was a wonderful profile of you on New York One the other day with Bud Mishkin.
Yeah, that was fun.
So I recommend people go to their website and check that out if you want to see Baratunde Thurston. So tell us about this event you did with Grover Norquist, the man behind the no tax pledge that virtually every Republican has signed. He's pretty hardcore. It's hard for me to imagine you and him on the same stage doing stand-up comedy.
Yeah, it's hard for a lot of people to imagine that being the same stage, same room, same time of day and year. But it happened again. In fact, I've done a couple of shows with Grover Norquist, political comedy fundraiser shows. And I am sad and annoyed to report that he's funny. He's actually a funny guy. He can tell a good one-liner. He's got an absurdist sensibility. And I want so badly to hate him. It's harder to do that when he actually makes you laugh. So his methods of undermining the federal government and possibly destroying America, according to my view, notwithstanding, he's a good comedian. And I had to acknowledge that he's a human being. I wished he were some kind of golem. He's not. So that was disappointing and uplifting at the same time.
I don't know if you can do this, just go into this mode because I asked you to, but can you channel Grover Norquist and do like a good Grover Norquist joke?
So Grover Norquist is he's very good at actually poking fun at himself and the right. And here's what he said about Mitt Romney last night. He said Mitt Romney was raised in Utah and was the governor of Massachusetts. So he hasn't lived in the United States either. And that was a paraphrase, but, you know, he's getting at the whole birth certificate thing. And he had he had things to say about himself and about his marriage to his wife. And he was he's a pretty self-deprecating dude humble on stage.
I bet the Colorado delegation laughed at that one.
They weren't in the room.
Baratunde, I gather that in addition to running around for WNYC, you're also part of this new project from Yahoo called Hash Out, and I want in on the Hash Out question of the day.
You want in on the...
Hit me.
Well, I want you in on the Hash Out. So our question today, it's a daily video question. The Republican National Convention has actually scheduled a mystery speaker for tomorrow night, as if you could schedule mystery. But who do you think that speaker should be, and why? That's my question.
First of all, I have to say this is one of the smartest things that they've done at the convention, because they've got people who might otherwise be bored paying attention, thinking, oh, who's this going to be? It's like the mystery guest on, you know, the rock show lineup, the concert lineup somewhere. So
yeah.
The biggest rumor that I've heard is Sarah Palin. So I'm going to go with Sarah Palin.
You're going to go? Now, do you think it should be Sarah Palin?
Should be?
Is there anyone you think it should be? Yeah, the question is, who do you think it should be?
Well, I think it shouldn't be George W. Bush.
Why would you say not George W. Bush? He's
because
the last Republican president. What could they possibly have to hide?
Because they're trying to hide everything about George W. Bush. They're
okay.
Trying not to bring up little details about his presidency, like his foreign policy and his domestic policy.
All right. So
I would be surprised.
Sarah Palin.
But Sarah Palin, who probably wouldn't have done well if she was the nominee, still energizes the base. And just as somebody who is a speaker on the convention floor, who has a certain appeal and who will make people gawk, I think that maybe from their perspective, of course, I don't know who else they're thinking of who might be even better. You know, maybe Bruce Springsteen is going to have an epiphany and come on stage and say, okay, Chris Christie convinced me I'm a Republican now. That would be better than Sarah Palin. But barring Palin is my best idea.
Your musical comment reminded me they played a song last night by Cheap Trick, I Want You to Want Me. And I can't think of a better soundtrack for a Mitt Romney GOP convention than that song and those lyrics.
Now, I'm sure that you've heard that the New York delegation has a prime spot at the convention, right up front, along with Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, of all places.
Mm-hmm. Heavy hitters all.
Have you noticed that the diverse states are featured more prominently on these cutaways?
I don't know what you're talking about, Brian. What do you mean the diverse states? All the American states are full of diversity and represent the greatness of the land. I don't know if you heard the roll call. Every American state is great. All of them. No, the Republicans are very good at image management and staying on message and on brand. So they have certainly positioned their diverse set closer to the cameras and to the stage than they might naturally be distributed. And that's part of the show. I mean, we're in the massive image management factory at both political conventions. It's a carnival without the funnel cake. They should probably just have funnel cake, actually, because it would make the whole thing much more fun and bearable for the attendees who aren't in on it. But, yeah, so the prime positioning of browner people doesn't come as a shock to me. That's why I'm running the Negro spotting game.
If they had funnel cake, then we would think we were at one of those bad street fairs in Brooklyn. But but I don't know. What are they going for with that, in your opinion? Because the serious political analysis that I hear is, yes, of course, with respect to Latinos, they know they're not going to get a majority. They're trying to pick off enough to make a difference in some of the swing states, but that the real name of the game in hardcore demographic political strategy terms is that they need to get to 61-62% of the white vote. So how does it help them to display, to prominently feature, the very small number of people of color who they actually have at the convention?
Because no one wants to actually look like they're exclusive. No one wants to look like they're racist. So even if Romney is left trying to fight for a higher percentage of the white vote because of his low numbers amongst various minority groups, it's still not a good look to just feature all white people all the time in your controlled brand experiment known as a political convention.
So it's to
white people don't want to feel weird and racist and exclusive either. So he's trying to tap into that moderate crew of the majority of white America who actually also values diversity.
Moderate voters who still have this nagging question in their mind as to whether the Republican Party is racist.
You know, Brian, you're so crazy, Brian. The stuff you say on this radio is just
Where would I come up with an idea like people may have that question in their mind?
Here's the other thing, and there's probably at least two. Which you look at the efforts at restricting access to the ballot through various voter ID laws across the country, and you match that up against the image management, and you see a large gap between sort of ideal and execution, between mission statement and behavior with this party. And it's much easier to manage the seating arrangements within the convention hall than to actually follow through and deliver on a proposition that is addressable to and open to everyone in this country. And what they're doing on the voting side of things is the very heart of anti-freedom. It's the opposite direction we should be going in, but it's a much harder problem for them to fix than just how they rearrange the deck chairs.
Baratunde Thurston, comedian, founder of Jack and Jill Politics, author of How to Be Black. He will be casting his jaundiced eye at the Democratic Convention for us next week, too. So have a good week. Don't get hit by hurricanes. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you. Look forward to it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And again, folks, don't forget the 7 o'clock call-ins I'm hosting on every convention night. We put together a network of public radio stations from almost all the swing states, so we'll take calls from around here and from the swing states, and we'll have some great guests too. Jonathan Capehart tonight, Jorge Ramos from Univision tonight. That's our 7 o'clock convention call-ins for our states and the swing states. Join me tonight at 7 here on WNYC.